From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And it's being described as a major setback for Republicans and President Trump. Last night's narrow defeat of the latest Republican effort to repeal Obamacare. The vote was 49 to 51, with Republican Senators John McCain, Lisa Murkowski, and Susan Collins joining all Democrats in voting down the repeal. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia was there on the Senate floor, and he joins us now. Senator, welcome back.
Good to be back with you guys.
So I've been covering this health care battle for weeks and months now, and I was surprised by what happened last night. Were you?
You know, not completely, although, I mean, I will say we weren't sure. You know, certainly John McCain's speech Tuesday was pivotal when he came back and he talked about the breakdown in the Senate and the need for both parties to work together and why not let great committee chairs and committee members work on bills together. That was very powerful, and the response to it was so powerful because everybody knew what he was saying was true. So then the question would be, okay, would we apply those lessons to this super consequential issue or not? And, you know, we were just all praying that, boy, if John just follows what he said, we'd get there. In fact, I gave a speech on the floor last night, and it was about WWJD, what would John do? I said, well, he told us what he would do. And so, but we didn't know for sure. A couple of things were pivotal. The Arizona governor came out in opposition to the skinny plan after 11 o'clock last night, and Senator McCain had always said that was going to be critical in his vote. And then we could see how frantic the lobbying was with the vice president and the majority leader and everybody, and we kind of could see from across the chamber that maybe John was planting his feet on our side. And at some point he came up to us about 20 minutes before the vote and told us he was leaning our way. But that was an agonizing 20 minutes of watching lobbying going on before the vote was actually cast.
Do you think that this is the end of Republican attempts to repeal Obamacare?
In the Senate, I think it is the end of the Republican attempt to just do a Republican-only version. I think what happens now, I'm a member of the Health Education Labor Pension Committee, chaired by Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, Patty Murray of Washington, the ranking. I think where it moves now is into the committee process, where you've got a Republican majority committee, certainly, so it's not like the Dems can just dictate terms, but what we can do, this bill never had a hearing, never went into the committee, which meant it never had a patient or a doctor or a hospital or anybody sit at a witness table and say, here's what works, here's what doesn't, here's what we need to fix. We now can actually listen to the public, listen to the experts, and then trade ideas with each other. Many of the committee members have bills in to improve our healthcare system that have not been taken up because of this effort by the leader to just force it to the floor without committee action.
But do you think that anything that would come out of the committee would be a repeal, or would it just be tweaking Obamacare?
Well, here's what I've said all along. Let's just find improvements. If you want to call it a replacement, you can call it whatever you want. And I may want to call it a reform. I think if we just skip over the label and just move to what can we do that will make healthcare work better for everybody. Use President Trump's three pillars. Nobody loses coverage, nobody pays more, and nobody gets kicked around because they have a pre-existing condition. If we can find solutions that will improve healthcare for all Americans, and I'll leave it up to anybody to call it what they like.
Well, the president tweeted last night, three Republicans and 48 Democrats let the American people down. As I said from the beginning, let Obamacare implode, then deal. Watch. So are you worried that he is going to do everything he can to try to weaken the Affordable Care Act?
Well, that's what his tweet suggests, that he would like to continue to try to weaken it. But, you know, that's just hurting people. You know, we didn't let the American public down last night. Overwhelmingly, the people calling in my office, the people I visited with at a medical clinic in Appalachia last week, were saying, help us, don't hurt us, make it better, don't break it. And the vote last night was a vote for that. It was to move into a process of improvement rather than breaking it. If President Trump wants to be part of the Wreck-It crew, he can do some damage, but I have confidence in my colleagues up here that we're going to be looking for ways to improve the situation, not worsen it.
What do you think this means for the rest of the Trump agenda? Are you expecting Republicans to move on tax reform or infrastructure at this point?
Tax reform, yes. I definitely think they want to do that. They've made that plain that they'd like to move it. The challenge on tax reform is not all the Republicans even start in the same place. So at least they can say, you know, on this one, well, we all want to repeal Obamacare tax reform. They start in some different places, but there are some ideas that I think have bicameral and bipartisan support. Infrastructure, we still have a little bit of a question mark. The president put out a one-page proposal that had some items that we like. It seems like a natural for working together between Republicans and Democrats, both in terms of members of Congress, but also stakeholder groups, labor, the Chamber of Commerce, mayors and governors. Seems like a natural. We haven't yet seen a sign of real seriousness about this from the White House, but that doesn't mean that we won't. So, I think there are plenty of items to work on and plenty of challenges that the American public expect us to solve.
That's Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia. Senator, thanks so much as always.
All right. Good to be with you.
While the senators debated the skinny repeal bill into the wee hours of the morning, the conversation was also taking place online. Hashtag skinny repeal was trending on Twitter. Danielle Belton is managing editor at The Root. She joins us from New York. So Republicans failed to pass a bill to repeal and replace Obamacare. How was that playing out online?
Oh, the response on Twitter was swift and brutal. On the left, they were joyous of the repeal failing, and there was nothing but crying Jordan memes imposed over Mitch McConnell's face. On the right, there was disappointment and bewilderment with accusations of McCain being a rhino, a Republican in name only. People also debated who the real heroes were of the night. Was it John McCain, who returned still recovering to the Senate to vote against it, or was it Senators Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, who have steadfastly been against repealing the ACA without a plan? Jeff Yang tweeted, Murkowski and Collins are the heroes today. McCain is the guy who signed on at the end of the project, presented it, and got all the credit.
It also seems like one of the newest members of the Trump administration, the White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci, is following the president's lead and using Twitter, in fact, using it a lot to share his opinions. Earlier in the week, he tweeted about a leak and later deleted that tweet. What happened there?
Well, basically, Scaramucci called Ryan Lizza with The New Yorker and had, quite frankly, a bizarre and profane phone conversation about these leaks that have been coming out of the Trump White House. And after he had this call, he tweeted, in light of the leak of my financial info, which is a felony, I'll be contacting the FBI and the Justice Department, hashtag swamp. And then he tagged Reince Priebus, leading many people to conclude the same thing Lizza concluded, that Scaramucci was accusing Priebus of being responsible for several of the leaks coming out of the White House. He deleted the tweet, but as we all know, when something goes up on social media, it's forever. And so people are still having conversations about it. I mean, he came out and said that he doesn't want Priebus investigated by the FBI. He claimed it was a public notice to leakers that senior administration officials are helping to end illegal leaks.
Scaramucci, this was all on the record. This wasn't something that he said was off the record when he spoke with the reporter.
Exactly. Apparently, he called Lizza and didn't say whether he wanted the conversation to be off the record or on background. He just went into a lengthy rant. He wanted Lizza to disclose who the leakers were coming out of the White House, which, of course, Lizza did not do. And, you know, Scaramucci threatened to fire everybody. He disrespected Steve Bannon. It was a very bizarre moment.
So what does happen when a tweet like that is eventually deleted? I mean, I know it has a long shelf life. What has to be done to really put an end to whatever kind of controversy was sparked by it?
I don't know if there is a way to put an end to this. I mean, tweets really are forever. People take screenshots. People have memories. The fact of the matter is, you know, he admitted to using vulgar language. He's admitted that the conversation was had. He said he shouldn't have trusted a reporter, which is, you know, was also bizarre because, again, he didn't ask for the conversation to be off the record in the first place. So I feel like this is going to have a long shelf life. This is going to follow him throughout his tenure with the White House.
Well, if we want to get off politics, let's talk about entertainment, because there were HBO shows trending on social media this week, including the improvised kiss on Game of Thrones. What was getting the most buzz, though, was a show that has yet to premiere called Confederate. The new series imagines what the United States would look like had the South won the Civil War. What's the conversation all about?
Well, the conversation has been about whether or not this show and the concept behind it is an alt-right fantasy, basically alluding to the white nationalist movement that exists both in real life and heavily online. Jason Johnson, who's a political writer for The Root, wrote that the creators of Game of Thrones, who've created Confederate, desperately want to create a world in which racial virtue is easy and requires no sacrifice or real challenge. In a world where slavery still exists, there are no sticky arguments about all versus Black Lives Matter to make white folks feel guilty. So there's been a lot of really harsh criticism. HBO programming president Casey Bloys said on Wednesday to the press that Confederate is a risk worth taking, saying everyone understands there's a high degree of getting this right. If you can get it right, there's a real opportunity to advance the racial discussion in America.
So is this the kind of thing where any publicity, even negative publicity online, is good publicity?
So I don't know how ultimately the criticism will impact. I think the programming president really hopes that people will take a wait and see approach. And in the end, we'll find it to be a quality product. But, you know, we'll have to see.
Yeah. And a lot more people are going to know about it, and probably a lot more people are going to watch it now.
Yeah, exactly.
Danielle Belton, managing editor at The Root. Thanks a lot for speaking with us, Danielle.
Thank you.
And let's get some historical context for what happened in the Senate last night. The defeat of the latest Republican effort to repeal Obamacare. Julian Zelizer is political historian at Princeton University and joins us now. Hi, Julian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, how significant a defeat is this for President Trump and Republicans in general?
Well, it's a big defeat. This is the major issue that the Republicans have been talking about really since the legislation passed. It was also President Trump's first major effort to get big signature legislation through Congress. And it fell apart, and it fell apart in a pretty embarrassing way for the Republicans. So it's a major defeat, and Republicans and Democrats will also remember now that the president can be defeated, and that will be significant in battles ahead.
Well, and we've had so many close calls since President Trump came into the White House where things were very close, and then maybe Mike Pence had to come in and break the tie. But it tended to go President Trump's way. The only other one I can think of that was a defeat for him was when the courts halted the travel ban, but then the Supreme Court later allowed some of the travel ban to take effect.
That's true, although this is really the first major piece of legislation that he's tried to push through as opposed to executive orders and or the Supreme Court nomination. And so this was his first test. How will he deal with Congress? And there was all kinds of evidence about the problems he faces as a leader not really understanding the legislative process and congressional politics, to this problem of constantly going off message and not really helping sell the idea behind the Republican bill until the point it was way too late.
One of the things that we would probably be talking about today if the bill were to have passed last night is that it was happening in the middle of the night, you know, the vote around 2 a.m. How unusual was the process of how this went through?
Well, the lateness isn't necessarily the oddest part of the process. I think what was really unusual was that by last night, Republicans were not even aware of what they were voting on.
Right.
There wasn't a very coherent health care plan that they were trying to push through or really even to amend. That's usually what we see. That's what we saw with Bill Clinton. That's what we saw with Medicare in 1965. This was kind of make it up on the spot. And I think it unnerved a lot of Republicans to be doing that. And it suggested a lack of a game plan, not in terms of the legislative, the political strategy, but in terms of what is the policy they're even pushing. That was very unusual to watch.
Well, you mentioned Bill Clinton. Let's take a listen back to some old tape here, because Bill Clinton obviously was advocating for health care reform in his presidency. The then First Lady Hillary Clinton led the effort. Here she is in 1993 testifying before Congress.
Health reform in this country is less a story of the typical American can-do attitude than a story of procrastination and parochialism and all too often greed, fraud, waste, and abuse.
Now, her plan ended up not going through. How big of a defeat was that for the Clinton presidency? Are there any lessons to be learned from President Trump when you look back at what happened with Clinton?
Look, that was a major defeat, and it also allowed the Republicans to take control of Congress in 1994. That said, President Clinton had some other victories, including a deficit reduction plan, NAFTA, which he claimed as a success, and some other measures that he was working on. So he didn't have an empty record by the time that the health care bill came up. But it was pretty devastating. This is a little different. This is about dismantling a program. But I do think he's going to face some pretty big political consequences. You've seen this week more and more Republicans and conservatives who are saying negative things about the president, who are willing to stand up to him. We saw three Republicans do that last night. And so he leaves this a weakened president. And healthcare often does that to all presidents. But added to that is the unusual nature of President Trump.
We also hear Republicans speaking out about Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell after this vote yesterday. Today, Republican Congressman Mo Brooks of Alabama was on CNN. He's running to fill the vacant Senate seat that belonged to Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Here he is criticizing McConnell.
The leadership at the top is responsible. The buck stops there. That's why you take on that kind of responsibility. And if Mitch McConnell cannot get the job done on this, how is he going to get the job done on the rest of President Trump's agenda over the next 3.5 years? As I see it right now, this is a killer.
Julian Zelizer, do you see a change coming in Senate leadership because of this?
Well, it's too early to say that. And Senator McConnell's a pretty cagey politician. He's not going to give up his seat that easily, and it's not clear who would replace them. But make no mistake about it, this was a major blow to Senator McConnell. This was his first test at seeing, can he govern? Can he push through comprehensive legislation as opposed to being an obstructionist, which he had been a very effective obstructionist for most of President Obama's term? And he wasn't able to deliver. It's very clear. That's what legislation shows you. Can you deliver or are you unable to? And Senator McConnell could not do it.
So just in the few seconds we have left, what does the White House need to do now to get their agenda going again, to get tax reform and infrastructure?
Well, I think they're going to push on tax reform. They need to find what's most appealing to the entire Republican Congress that they won't, the Republican caucus, where there won't be any defections. Many people think a tax cut is as Republican can be, and that's the best path to victory. But it's going to be hard. After a defeat like this, many Republicans are going to be skittish, and many Republicans are not happy with the president.
That's Julian Zelizer, political historian at Princeton University and author of The Fierce Urgency of Now. Julian, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's escape from politics and Twitter for just a few minutes and journey to a remote spot in New Hampshire, just a few hundred yards from the Canadian border. The Connecticut River, the longest river in New England, begins its 400-mile journey to Long Island Sound from a small pond in Pittsburgh, New Hampshire. All this month, a group of river lovers have been paddling the length of the Connecticut to highlight its importance and beauty. Todd Bookman from Here and Now contributor New Hampshire Public Radio caught up with them on the water.
Despite all of our pledge drives, New Hampshire Public Radio still doesn't have its own boat. And so...
Steve, you got room for one more?
There was your reporter, stranded on the shores of the town boat launch in Orford, New Hampshire.
Public Radio?
For Public Radio? Yes, the last seat on board the boat. And not just any boat.
Two, one, two, three, and...
For the next 2 hours, the Limetown Band in their royal blue polo shirts would be floating down the river on a pontoon. They played songs for the dozen or so kayakers making this leg of the trip. Bands, kayaks, bright sunshine, and a slight ripple on the water. This low-key event is just one leg of the Source to Sea Jump In Journey, a 2-week expedition organized by the Connecticut River Conservancy.
There we go. I haven't done an interview like this before on water.
About halfway through the band's set, Andrew Fisk, the group's executive director, paddled over in his kayak, grabbing hold of the boat's railings.
And how would you rate the health of the river in this section?
The river is really clean. Our next job is to make the river full of life. So right now we got a lot of life on the river with hands and feet, but we want to be able to get more life in the river that's got fins and flippers and claws and pinchers.
This section of the Connecticut is certainly much healthier than it was in 1959. That's the last time the Conservancy attempted one of these 400-mile advocacy events. It's the inspiration, actually, for the current voyage. There's footage of that 1959 trip posted on YouTube.
Greetings, my friend. My name is Davidson, Dr. Joseph G. Davidson of Equinox Mountain in Manchester, Vermont. My business is industry and chemistry.
Industry and chemistry, but Davidson was also president of the Connecticut River's advocacy group. The river then was a dumping ground for raw sewage and industrial pollution. Rusted cars lined its shores. Davidson, perhaps to prove a point, wears a gas mask in some stretches.
This trip on the Connecticut from the source to the sea opened our eyes to the treasure of the valley and some of the ways it is being destroyed through man's carelessness and lack of concern for the future of his own kind.
During the past 60 years, man has tried to reverse his carelessness. Advocates say the Clean Water Act, as well as a bipartisan tradition of conservation in New England, have made a huge impact on the river's health. Dave Hewitt is on the Conservancy's Board of Trustees.
In mid-1950s, they called it the most beautiful sewer in America. And now it's Class B. You can swim in it, you can boat in it, you can eat the fish that you catch in it. It's amazing.
The Connecticut River, for all its improvement, still does have its challenges. Fish populations are low, nitrogen levels are too high, and hydroelectric dams are causing erosion in some sections. But as the bandboat pulled up to shore in the town of Lyme, and a dozen kayakers uncoiled to enjoy cookies and iced tea, Andrew Fisk was hopeful about the river's future.
We should be incredibly proud of the fact that this river is so much cleaner and so much healthier because we have invested thousands upon thousands upon thousands of hours and hundreds of millions of dollars to make it a better river. But we're not done.
The journey isn't done yet either. The group is on their way to the Long Island Sound this weekend. But before getting back into their kayaks, one quick swim in the river they love. For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle, and it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
The economy grew at an annual rate of 2.6% from April to June of this year. That's according to the Commerce Department today, and it's more than double the rate of growth from the start of the year. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So this number is about what economists expected, but it's the fastest growth since the third quarter of last year. What's fueling it?
Well, consumer spending is far and away the most important part of the U.S. economy. And that notched up pretty strongly in this quarter to about 2.8% from 1.9% at the beginning of the year. And that is sort of accompanied by the stock market and home prices that continue to march higher, and unemployment continues to reach new lows. But another big number in this report was business investment in equipment, which rose at a more than 8% pace. So that's sort of a sign that companies are optimistic about the future and that this growth will continue on sort of a similar pace.
I'm surprised you didn't say anything about the weather, because if the number had been bad, we would have said, oh, it's because it was really rainy and
Absolutely. Well, and that's been a trend with the first quarter numbers throughout this recent business cycle, is that first quarter numbers have been surprisingly weak. Then there's been a snapback in the second quarter. So that's a little bit part of the story this year, too.
How does this compare to what we've seen going all the way back to the financial crisis in terms of growth?
Right. So if you start from when the economy began expanding again in late 2009 after the recession, the average for each quarter since then has been 2.2%. So this is definitely better than average. But again, there's this trend where the first quarter has been weak in many of those years. And that was true this year, of course. So if you look at the first half so far this year, it's about 1.9%. So a little bit below that trend.
And President Trump has promised 4% growth. Is that in the cards?
I think it's pretty unlikely at this point. For one thing, it's obvious that Congress is not going to act as a rubber stamp for President Trump's agenda. And that's becoming more clear by the day. But even absent that, there was always a little bit of skepticism among economists about getting to that 4% because it's considered above the economy's natural potential at this time. And the plans to push it there could possibly have caused a pickup in inflation and a pickup in interest rates that may have been a little self-defeating towards that goal. So there was always a lot of skepticism that we could reach that.
And Mike, just while we have you, the Food and Drug Administration released a proposal today that would reduce the nicotine level in cigarettes to try to make them less addictive. Tell us more.
Yeah, this really caught the stock market off guard. Tobacco stocks plunged across the board. Altria Group, which makes Marlboros, dropped as much as 19%. And it really has a lot of broad ramifications when you consider that the average sales tax on cigarettes, the state excise sales tax, is $1.74 a pack. So this is a very fascinating story. I think there's going to be a lot of debate, a lot of fierce lobbying from the industry about this. So it'll be something to keep an eye on.
That's Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you, Jeremy.
In May of 1969, Jim McLuhan was a 23-year-old Army medic serving in Vietnam. During the fierce battle for Nguyen Hill, he repeatedly returned to the kill zone and rescued wounded soldiers, even though he himself was wounded. McLuhan refused to evacuate to safety. In the end, he saved the lives of 10 soldiers and a Vietnamese interpreter. Now, 48 years later, President Trump will give McLuhan the Medal of Honor at the White House. Jim McLuhan, congratulations, and take us back to after you were first drafted, when you got to Vietnam, 1969, your first day was a wild one. What happened?
Well, yeah, we hit an ambush the very first day, so I was really initiated right into it. I had several injuries and actually shot my first enemy soldier that day, which was real shocking for me. Hard to explain that one, but I'm sure you can understand. And so, yeah, I got initiated real quickly, and we brought in medevacs and got everybody prepared and got them on a helicopter and got them out of there. Plus, I realized now I was in a war zone. There's a possibility I could be killed.
You were in the heat of a war zone when you and C Company were assigned to the Battle of Nguyen Hill. What mm-hmm. was the significance of that battle in that place?
Well, we were first told that we were going to be a blocking force and that a track unit was going to come over that hill, that Nguyen Hill, and flush out the enemy. The big factor was in our CO, which is our company commander, pointed out to the battalion commander that this was a flawed mission because no forward observers had been sent into that area to see how many enemy soldiers were actually on that hill. So here we are coming into an area blindfolded, so to speak.
The hill was called a hot LZ, which means the first minute you got there, you were fired on.
Yeah, that the area that we were dropped in was called a hot LZ, and for those listening, that means landing zone. When that happens, they will not land those helicopters. We jumped out from about 10 feet up in the air so that they could get out of there quickly and not get shot down, but we did have two helicopters shot down.
So you were one of only two medics among 89 men from Charlie Company going up against what turned out to be about 2,000 or more enemy soldiers in this Battle of Nguyen Hill. Can you describe what happened? And this is a battle, we should say, that lasted for a couple of days.
Yeah, 48 hours, correct. We got there in the morning, the 13th, and by the morning of the 15th, they had moved out. And because of the heavy support units that we had, they were chased out. But The second day, by the second day, we were down to two medics. And then Dan Shea, who was the other medic, he was the medic for first platoon. I was the medic for second platoon. And about his fourth or fifth trip out, he was mortally wounded. And so I brought him in. And now I knew I was the only medic left. And I had refused the day before, by the way, to get on the helicopter. I refused to get on because I knew that they were going to need me. I got close enough to Hill to see, like, lava coming down off of that hill from a distance. That's how many people were on that hill. And so now I knew when Dan had been killed that now I had made the right decision to stay, because now I was the only medic left to do that job.
During the battle, as you say, you were struck by shrapnel from a rocket-propelled grenade while you were helping two soldiers get out of the line of fire. Again, you refused to evacuate, and this happened, I think, three times, that you were bloodied, you were in pain, but you kept going. If you can describe what you remember about that feeling and the need to keep going and what you were going for, what you were trying to accomplish.
Well, my father had a factor in this, and athletics had a factor in this. My father told me if I had a job to do, don't do it halfway, and make sure you do it to the end until it's completed. The other factor would be the athletics, where I not only was it great that I was in good physical shape, but the mental discipline that I learned from those sports, I was allowed to focus and knew how to focus on what I had to do. Was I scared? Sure. I mean, I'm in a situation where I could die at any moment. But you had to keep your mind on what you were doing and evaluate the situation, how the wounds were, and then treat them and get them to safety as soon as possible.
What do you remember about the one particular moment when you were trying to save two other soldiers and you were exposed, and by the way, you had no weapons on you at this time, neither did they, and there were two North Vietnamese who were there who were armed. You were pretty much eye-to-eye to them, is that correct?
Yeah, once I got up on the hill, and that's when I got hit going towards the two gentlemen who were on a berm. I came out of a trench line and onto the berm, and they were pretty much scared. They were with a front squad that ran into the ambush, so I dragged them across the top of the berm and into the trench line. And I had given up my weapon because I knew I was going to need both of my hands no matter what it was that I would find once I got there. So I got into the trench line, and my two machine gunners had already started to retreat, but I looked up on top of that berm, and there was two North Vietnamese soldiers with AK-47s, and they were staring me right in the eye. I looked them straight in the eye, and they looked me straight in the eye, and I told the two gentlemen that I'd dragged into the trench line to follow me. One of them went the wrong way and became a prisoner of war, and the other one did not follow fast enough, and he was shot. So
It was the next day that Dan Shea, who you mentioned, the only other medic in the unit, was killed. You had to drag his body back.
Yeah, we brought him back in.
Can't imagine what that must have been like. But when you look back on it now, I wonder, what you think about in a situation like that, who lives and who dies. This is what all veterans face.
Yeah, all veterans wonder, why did they have to die and I didn't? And, of course, as Ronald Reagan had said many years ago, that they really lost two lives. They lost the one that they were leading at the time and the one that they never were able to have. Just a brief moment, it's like, oh, wow, I wonder what their mom and dad is going to, how they're going to feel when they find out. But it's just a brief thought, you know, and then it's back to focusing on, I need to get him in. I don't need to be killed, too. I'm the only medic left, so I better get him in.
After you left, first you got transferred to a hospital in Vietnam, the main hospital. And after you left, you returned to a career of teaching sociology, psychology, coaching, football, basketball, wrestling in your home state of Michigan. I wonder how your experience in the military prepared you for that and guided you through it.
Oh, it had a great deal to do with it, because now I had been to into a situation where it was life and death. And I knew that I had to prepare these young men and in classroom young men and young women for whatever Vietnam they would have to face. You see, we all face our own Vietnam. Maybe it's losing a friend. Maybe it's having parents divorced. Maybe it's losing a job or your home burns down. Whatever it is, everyone will face their own Vietnam. And I had faced mine, and I wanted them to be prepared to face whatever Vietnam it was they would face.
I know that there are a lot of people who owe their lives to you, I mean literally owe their lives to you, and are grateful for what you did. Do you feel in some way grateful yourself for having had the experience?
Well, people have asked me, would you go to war again if you were asked to go to war? And I tell them this, no one wants to go to war. But had I not gone to Vietnam, I would have never met some of the bravest, most courageous, most kind, loving people that I've ever met in my life. And this weekend is going to be great to be with them. We don't have to get back into the perimeter. We don't have to shoot at anybody, and nobody's shooting at us. And I sharing this particular award, and I'm only the caretaker of this award for all of the 89 men that went into that battle, whether they came out or they didn't come out. So it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and it's something that's surreal.
Jim McLuhan is a veteran of the Vietnam War, former Army medic. He will be receiving the Medal of Honor Monday for helping to save the lives of 10 fellow soldiers and a Vietnamese interpreter in a battle in Vietnam in 1969. Jim, thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
When I say gaming, you might think I'm talking about video games. But it turns out that even in the tech-savvy San Francisco Bay Area, there's a lot of excitement right now about board games, like old-school board games. Sonia Paul of KALW reports.
These days, the Bay Area is known mostly as a techie destination, but it also has a long history with analog gaming. Several dozen social board gaming groups exist in the region. Take this Saturday in San Francisco. Members of the Euro Gaming League, who focus on playing European strategy games, hosted an all-day event to celebrate International Tabletop Day. About 30 people are spread out among round and rectangular tables inside the community room of a local church. They play games that can last anywhere from several minutes to several hours.
My name is Linda Herbert. I teach kindergarten, and I live in Montera.
Montera is a small city on the California coast, about an hour away from San Francisco. And Herbert is the first to say she doesn't fit the gamer stereotype.
I'm older than everybody by at least 20 years.
She says she's close to 70.
I'm female. There aren't a lot more female board game players now, but you can see it's pretty much male-dominated.
Several years ago, her brother introduced her to Settlers of Catan, the European strategy game first released in 1995. She says it was a gateway game for her. And so Herbert began traveling all over, trying to find a gaming group that spoke to her.
I have a sister that lives in San Jose. I play games in San Jose and then go visit my sister. When I go on trips, I go on Meetup and try to find game players wherever I go.
Whether it's through Meetup.com or groups that organize on Facebook and Instagram, weekly, monthly, or off-the-cuff game nights take place at hobby stores, restaurants, and even landmarks like San Francisco's Ferry Building. Tabletop conventions and charitable fundraisers are also key players in this scene. But game designer Ali Hajigafori admits how some non-gamers wouldn't see the point.
Amazing outlet for that, tabletop gaming, because of the assumption that, oh, it's for nerds, it's too difficult, or they think of it only as the Monopolies and the Unos that are just for kids, so to speak.
But geeky has become cool, and the industry's economic rise is hardly kid stuff. These board and card games aren't considered toys, but hobby games. The trade magazine ICV2 found sales of hobby games in North America reached almost $1.2 billion in 2015. 2016 also marked the eighth year in a row the hobby games industry grew. And that rising popularity is not just about playing these games. It's around creating new ones, too.
What happens if these two were to get into a fight?
You probably hit me for nothing and I hit you for one.
Right.
Probably done.
That's probably sad for me.
It's designer night at Victory Point Cafe in Berkeley, the first designated board game cafe in the Bay Area. Every month, local game designers gather here to see how they can improve their game ideas. by playtesting prototypes with cafe customers who give feedback. The goal for many of them is to develop the skeleton of a game that's ready to fund on Kickstarter.
Kickstarter has really warped the tabletop industry.
Teal Fristo is a game designer and publisher.
And it's done so because creating a tabletop game requires a lot of upfront investment. It doesn't take a lot to create the idea and figure out how the game will work. What costs a lot is producing the game at a high enough quality that you can sell it.
Kickstarter's popular games category has raised more than $630 million in crowdsourcing money since it launched in 2009. When you break it down, it's clear what kind of games are in the lead. A company spokesperson reports that last year, video games and related hardware raised almost $18 million on Kickstarter. But tabletop games raise more than five times as much, over $101 million. One reason for this, Fristo says, is that people are tired of the screens and devices that already dominate many of our lives.
So tabletop games provide that non-screen and social gaming experience. And yeah, so what you get is a lot of people who are really excited about games, and they realize they can make them themselves, unlike making a video game, which requires a lot of technical expertise.
Plus, the games are evolving. Designers now often gamify current events and social issues.
As much as the swap was annoying, this now means we can build a large area and it will never be a square.
Oh, that's true.
Elliot Miller is here playtesting a game he developed about conservation, which was inspired by a local museum exhibit.
It's about balancing the needs of cities with conservation and trying to juggle both of them as like a city planner.
If the gaming trend keeps going, the Bay Area may soon be known as a startup hub for tabletop design as much as it is for tech. As Dutch cultural historian Johan Huizinga once argued, new cultures manifest in play. For Here and Now, I'm Sonia Paul.